The forest. Wow. My name is Marty Ruby, and I am an alcoholic. Am I too loud? Am I not loud enough? No one ever tells me I'm not loud enough, I can assure you. Get my timer going here. Oh, hell. Because, who knows, we could be here for hours. I know you're all getting a little nervous, aren't you? I haven't had to take a drink since October the 19th of 1989, and I'm as grateful as I know how to be about, I'm as grateful as I know how to be about that. And I'm a little nervous up here, to tell you the truth. You know, I was talking to some friends back in Austin, and I said, you know, I've been invited to Cook Forest, because I didn't know it was just the forest at that time. And they were like, oh my God, can you get us in? Like, no, doesn't work like that. But I gotta tell you, what a wonderful time I've had so far, and I wanna say that my hostess with the mostest, Maria, has been, and it's Maria of Clark and Maria, I don't know if y'all know that, and she's been amazing. And she's taught me so many things since I've been here. And of course, I got to listen to Mary, and I learned exactly how to say God, right? God. And there's some yens that goes on around here. And then, but really what Maria said was the most important thing, the terrible towel. I really want to thank Lynn and Ron, or I guess it would be Ron, for being my friends for the last couple of years. And I got to tell you, Cabin 12 rocks. Now, I probably shouldn't say that too loudly because you might be getting my pancakes or my jambalaya or my beef tips with noodles. I mean, it just goes on and on. You know, you go, it's just food and food and food and fellowship and fellowship. And what I've seen here so much is just this incredible outpouring of service. And I don't have to tell y'all that there's something very, very special going on in these woods. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, Dan. Thank you so much. And of course, the other speakers, Harold and Carl. Only going to say Harold one time. And Carl, and of course, Mary. You know, so they put us up in this incredible lodge, right, that overlooks the universe. And you know, so we, golly, we get out on our balcony and we go, this is an amazing view. And I swear to God, in the background, somebody goes, shoot a deer, please. And, you know, some deer kind of majestically walk out. I'm like, wow, look at that. So we get in the car, I kid you not, right? And we're coming down the road and to go to Cabin 12. And it's like this. Shoot the black bear, please. Really? A black bear's in the middle of the street going, hey. So never having seen a black bear, I was like, oh my God. Anyway, I've been having a ball, just having a ball. And talking with Carl, it was like this. He's like, you know, there's, you see about 25 people, and all of a sudden you go to a meeting, and there's hundreds of you. I don't know where you're coming from, but it's just been so wonderful. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. I guess that's why I'm here. I like to think a bit of it in a couple of different ways. You know, I'm going to share with you how I developed a personal relationship with the God of my understanding. And that's coming from a woman who had nothing when she got here. I'm also going to talk a little bit about my personal adventures before and after. You know, I haven't had to take a drink for almost 28 years. You know, and it's kind of like when you're 11 years old. I'm 11 and a half, or it's almost 28. It's never, you know. But I've had a lot of adventures. I had a lot of adventures before I got here. But man, I've had a whole lot more adventures since I've been here. Some good, some absolutely insane, and we'll see how that goes. But I was born to two pretty regular, normal parents. They were loving, they were kind, they were amazing, they were brilliant. My father was a rocket scientist, and he worked for NASA for 37 years. And yes, he actually did put man on the moon. He actually was a rocket scientist. And his philosophy to life was, Everything in the entire universe can be reduced to a mathematical equation. So there's not a lot of God in that, just FYI. Now, my mother, on the other hand, was Catholic. And I like that. Yes, she was Catholic, and so there wasn't a lot of science in that. And so what we did back then was, you know, we went to church. Now, Daddy never went to church, but the children, I have two brothers, and my mama, we went to church all the time. I was born in 1961. That makes me 56 years old. But I was born back then, and in the 60s, early 70s, it was a sin to not go to church. And so we went to church all the darn time. Now, I'm not here to say anything untoward about Catholicism or church or religion or any of that kind of stuff. But I'm going to tell you what my adventure was. And my adventure was that I went to this church, and the priest did this, right, at that time. And I just didn't get it. And it just left me flat. I didn't have a personal relationship with God. I didn't play church, you know. I didn't build an altar. I didn't do any of that stuff. Frankly, I was just kind of scared to death, you know. So I just kind of thought, well, I'll stay out of his way, and maybe he won't notice me. But I did have a certain kind of spiritual life, and it looked like this. God, please let Mama forget today is Sunday. And let me tell you, that prayer did not get answered. And so, you know, it was my first attempt at Santa Claus praying, and it didn't work. And so I thought, well, you know, okay, well, I'm good to go. Now, suddenly, when I was about 11 years old, and I don't, you know, so think about this, 1972, 71, the United States was kind of chaotic, and so a lot of things were happening. Free love and women's rights and civil rights, just something was on fire most of the time. And suddenly my mother came in and says, "We're not going to go to church anymore." Yeah, that's what I said, huh? I was very confused, but I was like, score. And I didn't ask any questions, and no explanation was really offered. And we just moved on. Okay. And what began to happen is in my family, now my parents weren't alcoholic, but booze was a part of every bit of our life. My parents were from Louisiana. I don't know if you know anybody from Louisiana. You probably don't know anybody sober from Louisiana. Now, that's not true. There's some fine folks in Louisiana. But it is the land of laissez le bon temps rouler, woo, Mardi Gras, all that kind of stuff. Booze was a part of every aspect of our lives. So I didn't know anyone that got sober. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just didn't know anything. And so what happened for me is my brother, my oldest brother, I being the baby, found his alcoholism early on. I was about 8. And things started to go crazy at my house because I believe that alcoholism is a family illness. And my family got very, very, very sick very quickly. And I just don't think my parents knew what to do. Early 70s, one more time, nobody really knew what to do. We didn't know what to do. I know Alcoholics Anonymous has been around for a long time, but we didn't know. My family didn't know anything about it. And so as my brother's alcoholism accelerates, my family disintegrates, as happens so many times in alcoholic families. So what do I do? Well, first of all, I'm pretty smart, and so I'm going to be really good. And what I discovered very quickly was that it didn't matter. If I was good, I didn't get noticed. If I was bad, I didn't get noticed, because all the focus was on the alcoholic. And so, well, worked out for me. I could get away with murder. And then I did. And I found my own alcoholism and came into it with a vengeance. I was thinking about this the first time I took a drink. I didn't just say, well, I wonder what alcohol tastes like. I said, let's get drunk, right? And that's what I did. And it was fun and it was great. And I just wanted to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. Isn't that funny? Even today, I'll go, you know, I wonder what a bottle of wine would be like. It's never, I wonder what a sip of a Tom Collins would be. I want the whole jug. What about a handle of vodka, you know? So I just never have thought like a normal person in all kinds of ways, I assure you. I remember I got out of school. I went to trade school very quickly. I wanted to get out of the house. I wanted to start making money. I wanted to get out. And I did that, and my spiritual life took on this aspect. And what my prayer looked like, I hadn't prayed since, please let her forget about church. But the next prayer I had was, God, if you just let me make enough money to drink as much as I want and to do all of alcohol's little friends, we'll be good. Well, lo and behold, that happened for me. And I always like think, you know, for a long time I thought, well, because I was all that and a bag of chips. But really what the truth is that I didn't pay my bills. I didn't pay my income taxes. I barely made the rent. And as a result, I had a whole lot more spending money, you know? I mean, think about it. And so what happens for me, as I think happens to a lot of us here, is a girl like me meets a boy like you. I mean, who else am I going to meet? Somebody normal? Never. You know? Dreadfully dull, dreadfully. You know, the normal guys were the kinds, you know, I pick my teeth with very quickly because I just eat them alive. You know? I just make them think they were crazy because I'm good at that. Right, honey? And then I'd leave them for dead because that's how I am. Anyway, but I meet a guy like you, and what's really important is that he drinks a little bit more than me, and he does a little bit more of alcohol's friends than me. So this way, I get to be the good one, right? I get to be the one that's holding it together. I get to be, you know, better, and that's always important to me. And so we go on along like this, And of course, it's love at first sight. Love at first sight. And within 6 weeks, we are engaged. Because that was a long-term commitment, really. Right? And you know, I thought, I'm going to pump the brakes here a little bit. And I say, you know, we don't want our friends and families to think we're crazy. So let's put the wedding off for 6 months. Sure. I mean, really, because this is the real thing. And we're going along, and we're doing our thing, and we're drinking around the clock, and all that other stuff, and I have this bright idea, as I'm prone to do, and I say to him one day, and I said, you know what we need to do? And he's like, yes. I said, we need to stop drinking for an entire week, so we'll know that this is the real thing. Now, I want you to stop and think about the insanity behind that right there. Right? A whole week. I mean, I thought that was a pretty significant level of commitment. And he looked at me and he said, what on earth would we do that for? And I can tell you, I was relieved. I was relieved because a week seemed like an awfully long time to consider going without a drink. I hadn't done it in years. So it doesn't take long. We end up getting married, of course, which we never should have done, but we did it. What happens for me is I start to become unemployable. Imagine. Because, let's see, I was living like a vampire, right? And not able to draw a sober breath. And, gosh, you know, people really like you to show up and do stuff in order to hold a job. And so what I did was I went into business for myself. And then, of course, you don't have to show up at all. And so that's how that went. You know, it doesn't take long for me in this marriage to become pregnant, right? Because I like to think on terms, you know, they have the warning bottles, the warning labels on alcohol. It says don't drink while pregnant, right? And what I figure is without alcohol, most of us never would have been pregnant in the first place. And so I end up pregnant. And what I think is that I'm going to make a choice to not drink. Because I have morals, and I have philosophical convictions galore, and I was raised by good people, and I know the difference between right and wrong, just like everyone in here does today. We know the difference, right? But I couldn't live up to them even if I had wanted to. And so what I told myself was, in the first trimester, that, you know, most women don't even really know they're pregnant in the first trimester, so I'll be all right, and I'm drinking. But then, you know, the second trimester comes and I white knuckle it for the next 90 days. Because, you know, I got some pride, right? And I still have that ability to hang on for 90 days. By the time I get to that third trimester, I say, well, everything's there anyway. He's just putting on weight. What's it gonna harm? Now I know better. But what I don't know is that I'm powerless, that I cannot manage the decision whether I will drink or not. I don't have it, but I don't know it. And so I'm drinking in that third trimester, and I'm scared to death. Of course you are. Of course you are. This baby comes out. He's fine. He does go on a little bit later to be the kind of kid who has a bucket on his head. I can't imagine why. But he has everything he's supposed to have. And he has everything he's supposed to have except for parents who can take care of him, right? Because we're so busy in our alcoholism. That baby is more of an inconvenience than anything else. Because, you know, it's really hard to live like a vampire when the baby wants to get up and eat and have his diaper change and things like that and be taught to read, whatever. And so, of course, what happens for me within not too very much longer after that is I end up pregnant again. You know, and it's not this blessed event that it's supposed to be. I'm like, oh, no, right? Because I have different priorities, and children are not my priority. At least that's what I think. And so by the time I get pregnant the second time, I have lost the power of a choice. I have lost the power to white knuckle it. I have absolutely lost the power to manage that decision of whether I will drink or not. And so I'm drinking and doing other things the entire time. And every time I look in the mirror, I say, oh my God, I hate myself so much. And I'm so frightened, right? And I don't want you to think this is strictly a woman's story. Because I know you men out there have fathered children or had wives or all that kind of stuff and have been right there in that. I know you have. And anyway, I go on and I miraculously have this second baby. And he's fine too. Or he has everything he's supposed to have. Except for two parents who are decent and able to draw a sober breath. Right? This goes on for a while. Now, a lot of people talk about how they come in and they come out and in and out and in and out and in and out and they have chronic relapsing and all this kind of stuff. Now, for quite some time, my mother had come to me and gone, I think there's something wrong with you. Is there something wrong with you? Do you need help? Now, by this time, I'm weighing about 90 pounds, right? I'm looking good, y'all. You know? I don't think I ate anything in the 80s, you know? And she would come to me repeatedly and I would tell her, you know what, I'm fine, I gotta go. You know what, I'm fine, I gotta go. And she would call me and I wouldn't answer because I knew that she knew. But there was nothing I could do. And what I would do is every night I would say, tomorrow will be different. Right? Tomorrow I'm going to get up, I'm going to eat breakfast, I'm going to clean the house because I'm basically living in squalor, as you do, And I'm going to clean the house. I'm going to take the kids to the park. I'm going to call my mother. I'm going to call my father. I'm going to do all these things. I'm going to be the person I want to be. And 10 o'clock would come in the morning. 10 o'clock in the morning would come. And all that was out the window. Because I was drinking again. And this went on for a long time. A long time. And you know what? I was one of those that had tremendous potential. And my world got smaller and smaller and smaller until it ended up being my living room, my bathroom, because I didn't need the kitchen, and the liquor store, and those houses where you go to get the other stuff. And it got very small indeed. Finally, what my spiritual life began to look like was, instead of all these empty promises I was making, you remember that time when you would make all these promises to yourself and you got to that place and you no longer believed your own promises? You remember that hopeless place? Because I do. I don't ever want to forget it. And I would make these empty promises to myself, and I knew tomorrow was going to be just like today. And I knew the day after that was going to be just like 3 days ago. And, you know, and it talks about in our book, days turn into weeks, weeks turn into months, months turn into years. And this was my life, only this was what my alcoholism looked like, right? And and I had this girlfriend, and her husband and my husband somehow were in business together. And she and I used to drink a lot. We'd drink a lot, we'd smoke a lot, and we'd talk about how bad we had it while we looked out over the lake in her backyard, you know? And one day she was telling me her tale of woe about her husband. And I had that cigarette in my hand and that glass of scotch in this hand. And I said, "You know what your problem is?" Glug, 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 glug. "I think you drink too much." Don't you love that level of ego? Isn't that something? And she looked at me like I'd hit her upside the head. And what do you think happens? She disappears. Yeah, she did. And I heard something about her doing this A&A thing. I don't know. It sounded crazy to me. And I thought to myself, she'll be back. She'll be back. And in the meantime, my spiritual life took this on. We've all said prayer something like this if we're sitting in this room today. I fell to my knees on a particularly bad morning. Actually, it wasn't a particularly bad morning. It was just Tuesday, you know? But every morning was particularly bad for me at that time. And I fell to my knees and I said, "God, I don't know what to do." And that was it. I got up off of my knees and I went and I did what I always did. But here's the thing. My God is swift, my God is mighty, and He is powerful. And He loves me so much, He sends the cavalry every chance He gets. Not 48 hours later, in my living room, sits my girlfriend, sits my mama, sits my brother, and it's the living room meeting. Oh yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Sure you do. Sure you do. "We're very worried about you. We think you have a problem. We're here to help." I'm like, whoa, didn't see this coming. But here's how they got me, right? So I don't care what your motives are for getting sober. I don't care how you get sober. Just get sober, right? Because this is what it looked like for me. First of all, they told me, we have a place for you to go. And we'd like you to pack like you're going on a cruise. I'm like, well, I am tired. I need a cruise, right? Who better than I to go on this cruise? Not only that, but I'm going to go get sober, whatever that means. I have no idea what that means at the time. And I'm going to do it so I can clean my husband out and get full custody of the children, right? And there's your motives. There's your spiritual motives for my sobriety, right? But let me tell you, weirder things have happened, maybe. But I end up getting the treatment, and thank God it was one of those 12-step based treatments. Imagine that. I'd never heard of anything like this, you know? But they start to teach me about Alcoholics Anonymous in the place that I went to. And I always like to say, my $17,000 big book, right? I think now it's about $77,000, depending on where you go. Worth every darn dime. It was for me. And I get into treatment, and of course they give me the whole spiel. You know, I get to work the steps in treatment and all this kind of stuff. I gained some weight in treatment. I had some meals. I actually slept. And I got out, and they said, 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, work the steps, get the service, da-da-da-da, do all this kind of stuff. And I said, okay, because I was willing to do anything to not have to live like I'd been living. And I didn't know, when I got to treatment, I didn't understand that what I drank, how I drank, how I thought had anything to do with how I felt. I didn't get it. But you began to teach me what was really going on in this crazy brain of mine. That I have a disease of perception. That I don't see the world the same way other people see it. That I will never see the world the same way other people see it. And that's okay with me today. So what happens is I am lit up. I'm on fire. I am excited. I love life. I am showing up for things. And, you know, this is great stuff. I fall into this group, the oldest group in Austin, which happens to be 5 minutes from my house. It's a meeting where there's about 100 people in it all the time. And let me tell you, there was a woman there and her name was Mona. And she was, when I came in, I was 28 years old. And when I walked in that room, she looked like she was 1,050. Right? She was probably 60. And she said, baby, you come sit right here by me. Changed my life. And every day I'd walk into that meeting, she'd say, baby, you come sit here by me. Every day. And chokes me up. And it wasn't too long, and they were telling me, you know what? We're going to give you a commitment. I'm like, yes! You get to empty ashtrays. I'm like, yes! I'm somebody now. You know what I mean? This was a big deal for a girl like me because nobody had asked me to do anything in a really long time. And I got to feel a part of something that was bigger than me. And I got to actually, you know, join the group. I began to work the steps, and I really began to join the group. And you know, really what my four-step looked was like a list of my grocer handicaps. As the best I could do, you know, and I got through my fifth step, and I was so excited, and I get in my car, and I drive off, right? And I realized there was this huge chunk of stuff I'd completely left off. Didn't even come up for me. But what had happened was there had been enough of the gunk moved away that some more stuff could come in, and I could take a look at that too. And I just keep going around and around in this inventory process, in this 12-step process. So I get lit up, and what happens for me is I get busy, right? And it addresses this specifically in our literature. It talks about how men will do one of two things. They'll either completely pour themselves into AA, or they'll completely pour themselves into business, right? And I think we gals can do the same thing. But a lot of times what it looks for us is we completely pour ourselves into our children. We're going to make up for lost time. I'm going to be at every dad gum baseball game. I'm going to be the homeroom mother. I'm going to teach Sunday school. I'm going to be the soccer mom. You name it. I'm on it. I'm signing up for it. Right? And I'm running it, baby. Right? I am running it. And what happens for me is I never make a decision to go, you know what, I think I'm making too hard a work of this deal. I don't really need to go to AA so much anymore. You know, because I was doing that whole 7 meetings a week thing. But what happened is next thing you know, I'm doing 5 meetings a week because I'm busy. And then the next thing you know, I'm doing 3 meetings a week. And then 2. And then 1. And then I haven't done any at all this week. And I'm really busy next week, right? And I get really busy. And this great big old life that AA gave me took me right out of AA. So what happens, right? Well, of course what's going to happen? How could it not happen? Because what happened for me is I stopped treating my alcoholism. And I began to become, I re-began being that extreme example of self-will run riot, though she usually doesn't think so. And so what happens is, you know, I'm white-knuckling my life. I am white-knuckling my life, and I hate everybody, and I'm in the bedevilments, and I don't even know it, right? But I am having trouble with personal relationships. I can't seem to be of real use to any people. You know why? Because I'm not. I'm not sponsoring anybody. I'm not doing anything. Yeah, I'm doing all this stuff with my kids, but it looks like this. Yeah, I'm going to be baseball mom, but you better put my son at first base or else. You know what I mean? Oh, gosh. So, it looks like everything is self-seeking. Everything has a motive. There is no altruistic giving. There's no generosity or charity of my spirit. None of that's going on. I have hall sex with my husband, you know, where we pass each other in the hall and go, screw you. Right? And what my solution to this is, you know what my best solution is to this? I'm going to have another baby. Dang right I am. I'm having another baby. And I do exactly that. Right? And so, you know, things just get crazier and crazier and crazier. And what happens to me is what happens to everybody, is that life happens. And this mother of mine, who's been this incredible figure in my life, gets sick, gets cancer, and is dead in 90 days. And let me tell you, I had nothing. I had no way to do that. Only thing I had was to blame God for my sorry life, right? And for anything that had ever happened. And if it wasn't God's fault, it was my husband's fault, it was your fault, it didn't matter, but someone had to pay. It didn't go well. Can you see one? It talks about the insanity returns and then we drink, right? I misread that for a long time. I thought I drank and went crazy because when I drank, I did a lot of crazy stuff, right? But it tells me once I'm sober that the insanity returns, the insanity of that first drink returns and then I drink. So that's why when they say, boy, you're drunk long before you ever pick up that drink. All I did somehow managed to not pick up a drink, but I was stark raving sober, I assure you. And I was practicing a program based on merely the abstinence of alcohol. Things didn't go well. But what happens for me, I got this great friend, and his name is Cecil. And it's, bless his little pinhead, he couldn't stay sober, you know? And so he goes off to treatment again, and he comes back, and I just love him. The minute I saw him, I said, oh, my God, that guy. Something about him. And, of course, I was married at the time. But he comes back from treatment, and he's going to this meeting. It's a 9 o'clock meeting. It gets started about 9:11. Yeah. No one in there has a big book. I don't know that anyone in there had ever seen a big book. Quirky, I like to think of it. But I got to tell you, he was going there, so that meant I was going there. And I would go to these meetings. And then I would tell him how bad my life was all the time. And he would do something like this. He'd go, well, have you prayed about it? Really? And I'd look at him and I'd go, no, why don't you pray about it? And he'd say, in his 5-month-old wisdom, okay, I will. What am I going to say to that? Okay, then fine. See if I care. Spiritual giant that I am. I think I had, 8 years at the time? Yeah, 8 years. Whew. So I think he did. Needless to say, my mother still dies. Right? Of course she does. And I go crazy. Well, you know, a lot of things can happen when you are in untreated alcoholism. And I certainly was. And even though, once again, I had moral and philosophical convictions galore, I started having an affair. And I started having an affair with Cecil. And a lot of people got hurt as a result of that. And I'm not proud of that pain that I caused other people. But I'm here to tell you, there was overlap between, you know, husbands. And that's my story. And I'm here to tell you that alcoholism, just as well as alcohol, is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Right? Now, I'm not saying I would do it any differently, but I sure do have remorse about the people getting hurt. However, he and I have now been together 20 years. Worked out for us. He has taught me more about life than any other person in my life. So, what happens for me, like I said before, is that God loves me so much that he sends the cavalry, right? And so I'm making myself available in these meetings. I'm making myself available to what, you might say? Well, to the consciousness of the presence of God in my life. And this consciousness, because I can see it happening in his life. I can see it happening in his. I can see it happening in hers. I can't ever see it happening in mine, right? But I have this, it's so great. There was quite a cast of characters at this quirky little meeting. And one of the cast of characters in there was a woman named Katie P. Some of you may have heard of her. And she comes up to me in that meeting, and her husband had just died. And she'd walk up to you and she'd kind of like, woo, because she was crazy at the time, as was I. So, of course, we're totally attracted to each other. And she says to me, hey, can you sponsor me? I'm like, why, yes, I can. I mean, why couldn't I? I don't have a message of depth and weight. I haven't worked the steps in years. I don't know where my book is or anything like that, but I remember that books and steps and sponsors had something to do with this stuff. And so I got a book. I got a sponsor, but I took about 2 or 3 months to call her. And then and Katie and I began to sit on my carport and smoke cigarettes, cry, and read the book. And all I knew how to do was to stay one page in front of her. And that's all I knew how to do. And I got to tell you, that was enough at that time. That was enough to commence shoulder to shoulder on this journey. Now, would it keep me sober today? No. No. But it did at that time. And we got started on this thing. So, I found a woman, and this always makes me laugh. I used to go to this other meeting on Saturday mornings because, you know, once I started kind of reading the book, this quirky little meeting got a little less interesting. Do you know what I mean? And so I started going to other meetings where people were actually talking recovery, where people were actually talking about the 12 steps. And I found this women's meeting on Saturday morning. And there was a woman in there, and her name was Belinda. And gosh, dang it, every time she opened her mouth, just really profound things seemed to come out of it. And so I sat there and listened to her for a couple of months because I'm a quick start, you know what I mean? And I said, you know what? I have an idea. I'm going to go ask her if she'll talk to me about step one. I have a fear of commitment, y'all. You know what I mean? I'm not going to ask her to sponsor me. I'm just going to ask her about step one. And so I get up and I start walking across the room, right, to go ask her about step one. And as I walk across, you know, you hear that voice inside, that still, quiet voice that goes, why don't you ask her about all 12? I thought, who said that? It's ridiculous. And by the time I got over to her, I said, would you sponsor me? This is crazy. And she's one of those that if she said yes, oh, you're going to start working. Oh, you are going to be working. And what she did most importantly was she showed me in the book. She didn't tell me, here, read this and give me a book report on it. She sat down with me and she showed me in that book. She showed me where selfishness and self-centeredness was the root of my problem, right? She taught me how to resolutely look for my own mistakes. She made me understand that the inventory is mine and not the other man's. Now, wait a minute, did you not just hear what I said about him? But no, bringing it back to me, to look at life from an entirely different angle. Wow, I'd never heard this in the first 10 years of my recovery. That does not mean to say that people weren't saying it. I have no doubt they were. Because I remember grumpy old Bob in the back corner of the room who'd start talking about the book, and I'd start rolling my eyes, and, you know, and he'd say things like, action, action, and more action, and I'd go, crazy, crazy, more crazy, you know, because I didn't want to do anything different. I didn't know how to do anything different. I didn't know how. And until someone sat down with me knee to knee, one alcoholic talking to another in this ever-repeating network, right, did I begin to understand what it is we do here. And my life began to change remarkably. You know, it talks about, I always think about sudden and profound experience with God versus the educational variety. And for a long time, I thought I had to have one or the other. Right? It was either sudden or profound, or it was educational. But you know, when I go from being able to not drink, from being able to not drink, to being able to not drink, to being connected to that power, that is nothing less than sudden and profound. But it has taken me, I still continue, I hope, to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life so that I can meet the certain trials and low spots ahead. It's coming. How am I going to be prepared? I spent a lot of time thinking that I could protect myself from being hurt, that I could protect myself from being scared, that I could protect myself from being in some kind of relationship with you that wouldn't perhaps feel that great, right? Today, I don't even want to. Because I know I don't need to. I think God's going to protect me. I've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. God's going to take care of all of that. And today, I want to feel everything. Before, when I was drinking, it's not that, you know, people say, well, I want to change the way I feel. I don't want to change the way I feel. I want to feel nothing. Nothing. That, to me, is oblivion, right? And that's what I always sought. And if I'm not careful, I can do it today. I can do it through Amazon.com, right? What package is getting sent to my house today, right? I can do it through a million different ways. I don't know about you, but I've binge watched Game of Thrones, all 7 seasons, right? You know, and I can sit there and feel nothing. But that is not what life is about for me today. It's not, because for a million reasons. What does my spiritual life look like for me today? You know, it begins to look more like, when I did that, you know, early on in that step process, what I would do is 1 through 5, pretty good. You know, I thought I had a really good grasp on that. And then, you know, there's only 2 paragraphs on 6 and 7, so what's the big deal? And then I'd move into 8 and 9, right? And I'd make those amends. And then 10, 11, and 12 looks like this. Sit still and let me help you, right? And you're kind of going, I just want to get away from you. And I didn't get it. You know, and today what I understand is when I do that all the way through all of those steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I get to look at myself, you know, it's a fact-facing, fact-finding process in step five. I'm going to face the facts, my sponsor's going to find them, right? And then I'm going to bring it into 6 and 7, and we're going to look at what's objectionable to me, right? What's objectionable? Not what's objectionable to you. I can assure you there is a lot more about me that's objectionable to Cecil than there is to me. Right? Right? But it's not objectionable to me. So I have to take it and see, is it objectionable to me? And I love that question. So much of the stuff that's built into our literature is about how we do it wrong. So we have this part that says, if there's still something you cling to, we ask God to help us be willing. Right? So what is it I'm clinging to? Oh, I got volumes of stuff I'm clinging to. I clung on to my children for the longest time. I was not going to give them over to God because I knew if I did, God's going to kill them. Right? That's just the way it was going to be. I'd been so horrible that I was going to have to do some kind of penance because I had this terrible old idea about God. See, I was holding on to old ideas, and the result was nil until I could let go absolutely. Right? So I had these old ideas about God, and I was clinging tightly to that stuff, tightly, until I realized that the reason I was so terrified, because it says so in my book, is because self-reliance was failing me. What I kept trying to do was think my way out of everything, which is exactly what I'd done before I sobered up and worked the 12 steps. What happened for me is I had not gotten down to causes and conditions. I just got down to the grosser handicaps, right? Not if any of this is making any sense to you. No. Okay. Anyway, so I get down to causes and conditions. I begin to turn that over to a God of my understanding. And the more I turn things over, and the more I begin to see my life change, the greater my understanding becomes of my higher power. And now this to me is what it means to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life. It doesn't mean I'm going to be perfect. It means I'm going to try. I'm going to try really hard. And I'm going to seek and I'm going to look. You know, the best thing that happens for me is I get to sponsor other people. That's what makes this thing work, in my opinion. You know, if I want to hear what's in the big book, I get a sponsor. But if I want to really learn what's in the big book, I sponsor someone else. Right? And I take them through it. And I get to hear it over and over and over and over again. And this way it becomes a part of me. And I am so grateful for that. So I ask God to build with me as He sees fit today. What, you know, because I've got great ideas on what I think my life should look like. All the time. And most of the time, those really aren't in agreement with what God thinks. And so I had this great conflict for the longest time about what I thought my life should look like and what God thought my life should look like. And it was a power struggle, you know, and which is so absurd to hear myself say that at this point. Power struggle, like God's not going to win. Just saying. So, once I can just say, you're the one with all the power. And what my experience has shown me over and over and over again, not just in my life, but in your life as well, that God's got it going on, you know? And when I can do that, remarkable things follow when I stay close to Him and perform His works well. So, you know, I like to talk about that amends process. You know, I had been sober for about 15 or 17 years. And there's a great line in the 12 and 12, and it says, in the eighth step, that, you know, we are to now have the best possible relationships with everyone we know. And when I looked at that one day, I went, you know, I haven't talked to my brother in years. And I haven't talked to his wife in a lot more years than that. I just didn't have any use for her. You know what I mean? And as if that's okay. As if I get to do that as a person who is practicing a spiritual program. So I got to work and I did the inventory on my sister-in-law and on my brother. And I began to see that, you know what? It wasn't them. Because I was taught to resolutely look for my own mistakes. And what I got to see is that I had treated these two people so poorly in my life, right? And what I had done to my brother was make him choose between either his wife or his sister. Guess which one he chose? He chose his wife, as he should, right? And I got to look at this work, and it was powerful, powerful work. So, what do you do with that? Well, now I'm ready to make amends. Ta-da! And so, at the time, my brother was living in Idaho, which is far from Texas. But I am ready to go. I've got my amends. I'm ready to make it. I call him up. I'm going to go see him because that's what I've been taught to do. You go face to face, right? And so I'm ready. Call him up. Doesn't take the call. Right? Hey, you know what? I'm going to Facebook friend my sister-in-law because it's kind of a chicken way out, but I'm going to do it. And I send that friend request. That's what she said. So So what I did was, I think to myself in my own grandiosity, well, there must be a mistake. I'll friend request her again. Where's that horn when I need it? Yeah. She doesn't accept the second one either. In fact, she responds, not at all. So I'm texting my brother. He's not responding. So after, I don't know, 10 times, because I am persistent, it dawns on me with a little help that they don't want to talk to me. They're not interested. They don't want to hear what I have to say. Right? Ouch. Hey, wait a minute. I'm supposed to get a pony. I've done the work, right? And so what my sponsor's advice, guidance is to stand ready. To stand ready. There may come a time and there may not, but you have done the work and you stand ready and you are safe and protected. Years go by, right? And one morning I get a phone call and it's my sister-in-law. What the hell? And my brother has collapsed. They've now moved to Corpus, who knew, which is about 3.5 hours from where we live. And my brother has collapsed. He has a pancreatic aneurysm. And I know enough to know that my brother is drinking himself to death. So what do we do? I do what you've taught me to do. And I look at my husband and we say, let's get in the car. And in 20 minutes, we're on our way to the hospital in Corpus Christi. Now, I'm also of the school that says you are not about to go into someone's hospital room and make amends. You're not going to go to someone's birthday party. You're not going to go to someone's wedding or baptism or divorce court or any of that stuff and make amends. It's already been enough about you. Okay, I'm good. So I get down to the hospital and I look at my brother and he looks at me and we both know where this is going, right? My sister-in-law does it and she's fighting with every ounce in her body to keep my brother alive. And those of you who have watched someone die from alcoholism, you know it's just horrific. And so I'm in the hospital room with my sister-in-law, my brother, and boy, oh boy, oh boy, do I want to make amends. And I'm like, oh no, ma'am, you will not. Oh no, ma'am, you will not. About 3 days into this, I can see my brother's not leaving this hospital room. Not alive. And I can see that my sister-in-law's not going to leave his side. And what do you do? So I prayed. And finally there came a time, I just got on my knees in front of my sister-in-law and I said, you know, and I made those amends. I've treated you horribly. You didn't deserve any of it. And I can't tell you how sorry I am. And of course she looked at me and she said, that's all done and gone. Powerful, powerful, powerful. And I spent the next 5 weeks in the hospital with my brother. And what I know is that he died knowing his sister loved him with all her heart. And his sister knows that he loved her with all of his. And without you in this program, I would never have been able to do any of this. And I can never, ever, ever forget that. So, what does my life look like today? You know, how can I best serve you, God? What can I do for you? Somebody gave me a prayer when I was in treatment. It was a priest that would come in. And he said, the only thing you need to know how to pray is this. God, what can I do for you today? That's a prayer I still say, 27 and change later. And that's all I want to do. What does that look like? You know, my husband and I have an AA house. And I just love that. And there's always somebody coming in and going. And it's just a powerful, powerful place to be. I can tell you that I wasn't in here before. And my heart was cold. And I was lonely. And I was angry. And I was terrified. And my world was about this big. My whole world could fit on the head of a pin. You know? Thank God you captured me and brought me in here and sat me down and said, baby, I got a chair right here for you. You graciously showed me how to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you did that, you did it for fun and for free. For fun and for free. And my heart began to soften, right? Just a little bit, just enough. Just enough to let you in. Once my heart was softened, what you showed me how to do was have a relationship with a God of my understanding. Not yours, but mine. My whole world opened up. It got huge, suddenly, profoundly. You began to fill my heart with love. Love, something I didn't even know I wanted. I didn't even know I wanted. I really just wanted you to stay over there. But next thing I know, you're up all up in here, right? You know? And I used to think that everything that happened in here was true. And I heard all the time that I got to get what's up here to percolate on down into my heart, right? As if I need this mess to go down into my heart. What I've experienced is that, no, my heart knows the truth all the time. My heart always knows the truth. That's why when I look at myself in the mirror when I can't stop drinking, I hate myself. Because I know I'm living in complete opposition to my values. What I believe today is that my heart has to percolate up into my head. You fill my heart with love and then the world exploded for me. Just exploded for me. I'm standing in Cook's Forest for God's sakes. I and my family owe you a debt I can never, ever repay. Ever. You saved my life and you saved the life of my family. What would their life have been like? And you did this on a Tuesday afternoon. You know why? Because I reached out for help, desperate. My mama reached out for help, desperate. And you said, I know the way. If you're not working these steps like your life depends on it, because it does, please, I beg you, let us show you how. And thank you so much for having me.